Sorry. Sounded great to that point. I was trying not to stop you, but thanks. I appreciate it. Yes, right. I don't know how this piece goes.
I first heard Rouse's music at the world premiere of his first symphony in Baltimore. I was the soloist on that concert. And I remember going into the audience for the second half to hear this symphony being played. And it was overwhelmingly powerful. It really moved me how dramatic and how grand his visions are. And a couple years later, the Aspen Music Festival wanted to celebrate my teacher Dorothy DeLay's 75th birthday. This was in the early 90s. And they asked me if I had a choice, which composer would I like to have commissioned? And I did not hesitate. I asked for Chris Rouse immediately. And Rouse obliged, and he wrote a fantastic violin concerto for me, which I have recorded and performed in many, many places. So I've gotten to know Rouse a little bit over the years, and we share similar passions about music and with cigars. And so what we have done this year is that I'm very lucky to have brought him, because usually he takes August off, and believe it or not, he actually likes to go to Orlando to be with his family at Disney World. I don't know who wants to be in Florida in August, but he's very passionate about Disney for some reason. But this year we got lucky, we got him to come. We couldn't get a commission out of him because his waiting list is about 6 to 8 years long. So what we did is that we brought two of his chamber music works here. He has written very few chamber works. Most of his output has been in orchestral works. So we were very fortunate to have not only his music, but a great exponent of it in Calder Quartet being in residence here as well. So it's a fantastic collaboration.
If you're willing just to play the beginning of the piece, what I had in mind was two bells just kind of ringing at slightly different times, one on an A and one on a B. So this motive of ba-dum, 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 if you can imagine that as two bells just going at the same time. If you would just play the first four bars or something, if that's okay, because it's in the strings at the beginning. The harp just plucks individual notes, but later on the flute and clarinet have it as well. There really isn't a program to this piece in the sense that it's a storytelling piece or a narrative. It was inspired by a visit to Rome in which I went as a tourist and excited to be here, all this great food and let's go see the Colosseum and so forth, but then was increasingly struck by the effect that the Vatican or that the church has had throughout the entire city, not just in Vatican City, but through all of Rome. And increasingly found myself more and more in various churches in Rome, spending less time with Roman antiquity, which I still love, but more time with things related to the church. So it's a piece that in a sense begins in the mode or the mindset of a giddy tourist and ends up perhaps in a somewhat more spiritual way. But beyond that, it's not a descriptive piece. So what I would hope someone would get out of it was some knowledge of the Roman experience that I had, a sense of this progression from a certain kind of secular quality to something that's perhaps a bit more sacred. But beyond that, I wouldn't say that there needs to be some sense of following a tale that's being told.
For me, it's staying a little too loud there. If we could bring it down a notch there, I think we still have some space to break it down further later on. This one's for good, you guys. For 429. 5 to 429. Have you still got some more oomph left in you there?
Sure.
Remember? Just go from there. 5 to 429.
More?
Those 5. Bars there. Just go completely.
Mm-hmm.
That should be the loudest thing you play.
We were fine until 26.
Around 19. Could you still, even in the quiet stuff, still give me a little vibrato? 19.
Yeah, 19.
Or no, 19. Just a little vibrato. Even when you're playing 3-4 peaks, just a little bit to warm it up.
Really
great
17.
17? Yeah, you were great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
Just a compliment.
Good.
No problem. Yeah. Well, I have the paste bent down for some reason.
Well.
Oh, yes. Okay, for the strains again, sorry. Actually, just for 2-4-7. A little less pushing. That one should be noticeably less than the mezzo piano. That's a 4-4. That's the major thing. Just that one. Why do I have this turned down? It's around rehearsal. Oh, I know why. Yeah. Jonathan, yeah. Right. Could you do more off the string there?
More up.
Yeah. At the 4-7. And this is for Andrew. There. Starting 5-4-7. Do you have any kind of left in you?
Yeah.
Because the flute and clarinet are really in the shoot. They're very strong. You need to try to manage it. And that's it for me. I think it sounds terrific.
Yeah, I need to do that.
Chris, the tempos, the slow tempos?
Tempos sound fine.
All right.
If you're okay with it.
The Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center commissioned this piece, and they wanted a work that they could take on tour with one of the other pieces that has the same kind of somewhat unusual instrumentation in which that organization specializes. So we talked about various works, and they suggested the Ravel Introduction Allegro, that scoring for flute, clarinet, harp, and string quartet. And I said, okay, well, that sounds fine. That should work. And so that became a given, that I was going to be writing for that combination of instruments.
Chris starts this piece frenetically, and we're playing the same thing over, and I just counted the measures really quickly, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's about 98 measures of the same repetitive frenetic energy. And then suddenly, after going 1, 2, 3 for 98 bars, we have 1, 2, 3, like that. And we have to land on the next measure all at the same time. So that's what we're rehearsing, so that it sounds perfect. Just so you like know what we're doing. Goes from 3/4 to 3/8, which is faster, and then we have to continue in 3/8 after 98 measures of chaos. Seven?
Is that seven? Sure.
And the clarinet together are the kind of, I don't want to oversimplify this or be too glib, but they're kind of the gigglers. They're the tourists in the piece. They're the ones who go to Rome and just think, oh, wow, isn't this great? We're in Rome. The strings are the more contemplative for the most part. And I did think of this really as the woodwinds as a pair, as a single entity that are paired, the strings as a quartet grouped together as a lump, and the harp as kind of the free agent in the work. And so because the flute and clarinet are these kinds of bright, celebratory, happy kinds of instruments, the range that I use for both instruments tends often to be quite high. And so the flute does come off, and the clarinet too, for that matter, can come off as being a bit shrill on occasion. They're not meant to be threatening or in your face, but just meant to be really ebullient and just full of ginger and excitement.
Can we do 2 before 26?
Oh, did you want to do 20, though?
We will. But we'll do this first. We'll prepare this first.
Okay.
We had a couple of casualties.
No, actually, could we do 25 to 26? Because I think that actually entrance
Okay, 25?
Yeah.
The strings repeat what I thought of as a kind of a bell motive. The idea was of two bells ringing different pitches at slightly different speeds. And that's the material that the strings play at the beginning of the piece, but it's used elsewhere in other instruments as well. But it does involve a little motive that one hears measure after measure after measure. So some people think of this as a minimalist piece because of that. I understand why people would think that. I wouldn't say that on the whole it's a minimalist piece, but certainly it has elements of that. Thank you. The string quartet has done this piece in Aspen, and I think another time somewhere. Nancy Allen, the harpist of the New York Philharmonic, has played it with the New Music Group at the Philharmonic and also Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And the flutist and clarinetist are both members of the L.A. Philharmonic and have played it with the Green Umbrella series up there. So they've all played the piece, but with other people. So this is the first time that this woodwind duo has played it with this harpist and the three of them with the string quartet. So they're coming together in a new configuration. But they all know the piece very well and play it wonderfully.
32? Mm-hmm. And then, what did you start at 32 as well? Was that 32? 32?
Writing chamber music for me is always a challenge. Not that I do it very often, and perhaps that's the reason it's a challenge. Almost all of my music is for orchestra, and I feel very comfortable. I kind of think in my sleep almost for orchestra. So that when I'm writing a piece for a small group of players, it really brings out in me the need to do something different than what I might more automatically do. I remember when I was writing this piece, I came up with all sorts of great ideas for what the brass could do here, and the percussion. Let's have some antique cymbals there. And then I'd say, oh no, I don't have percussion. I don't have brass. So I had to really rethink the way that I deal with instruments and with sonorities, writing for this kind of ensemble. I don't want to dictate for anyone what music should be. My feeling is that music has to be about communication first, that the techniques involved in organizing a piece of music should be there to serve that expressive intent and to make it coherent. Because one can just kind of babble on, just kind of have an emotional outburst in the form of a tantrum or some such thing. If there's no organization, if there's no logic to it, it's an equally unsatisfying experience, I would say, to something that is entirely cerebral, mathematically controlled or whatnot. I think that technique has to be the servant of expression. And I agree that music that clearly is not intended to express anything at all is music certainly I don't want to hear, and I can't imagine that anyone else needs to feel guilty if they don't want to hear it either.
Harmonics are enough, Chris? Can you hear all the harmonics?
Yeah.
At the end?
Yeah,
okay. So I just need to stare at it so I know that I won't lose my concentration. I just wasn't paying attention to where you were, and then suddenly I couldn't. I tried and tried and tried, and I couldn't match up at once with either instrument. I was lost. Sorry. Can you give us two bars before?
Two bars?
Yeah.
Well, the purpose of all music from the time of plain chant on until we got into the 20th century was to elicit emotional responses and describe emotional states in music. I mean, plain chant was about instilling a sense of piety and awe in those who experienced it. And that goes right on through the Renaissance, Baroque, Classical, Romantic, and much of the 20th century as well. I think the problem begins with Schoenberg, the problem begins with Wagner. The seeds, even though he's a great composer, the seeds of trouble are in these magnificent achievements, these great operas of his, or music dramas. But he was an extraordinary composer. With Schoenberg, who frankly I don't feel was as good a composer, this notion of the composer as God, which was a Wagnerian notion, becomes the composer as unintelligible or unknowable God. You can't possibly understand what I'm doing. And so, therefore, the public, I withdraw from you, and I will go into the Society for Private Musical Performances, which Schoenberg founded, and only other initiates into the mysteries of what it is that I'm doing will be given the honor of exposure to my work. That attitude, I think, was where the trouble really began. And the private musical Society for Private Musical Performances then morphs after the Second World War, particularly, into the Academy. And one can withdraw into the Academy, write music that is really intended just to be performed and heard and studied within the Academy, and essentially ignore the larger audience of the concert hall. And I don't think that that is inherently healthy.
That's great. Can we just do it started on? So, like, it's really pale.
Right after
the right on, it's fine.
eighth bar, can you give
yes.
me a little look?
Yep.
Just
yep.
a little bit, so I know.
I think that the issue of dissonance is not as important a one as the issue of expressivity. If a piece of music is meant to say something emotive and communicative or not. And I think music can do that through a consonant language, a dissonant language, a simple language, a complex language. Those aren't really the main issues. I think the most important issue is that issue of expressivity. And a lot of the 20th century, particularly after the Second World War, but certainly before as well, is about getting away from expressivity. That was seen as a 19th century concept, romanticism and all of this emoting and so forth. And so we have composers who, in many cases, write music that may be brilliant, it may be intellectually exciting, it may be colorful, it may have all sorts of qualities, but is not moving. Even Stravinsky. How many pieces of Stravinsky move you on a deep spiritual level? They excite you.
Yeah.
The Rite of Spring is an exciting piece, and I love it. I get wrapped up in it, but I'm getting wrapped up in a kind of a visceral experience. But Stravinsky's the composer who said music is incapable of expressing anything at all. And I find a great deal of his music, however elegant and beautifully wrought, doesn't speak to me on that emotional level. And so it's music that I admire, but I don't love, for the most part, at least after the Russian, those early Russian ballets and so forth. Those are wonderful. But later on, I feel certainly the same about Schoenberg. To some extent that way about Bartok, Hindemith. The composers I love from the early part of the 20th century are Sibelius and Prokofiev and Shostakovich and Ravel and all the people we don't study in universities. Basically, I want all of my music to be responded to in an emotional way, and I try. Most of my pieces have some kind of trigger or some kind of inspiration that is specific, something that has happened in my life or something that I've experienced or feel a certain way about. And I tend to make some basic comments about that in the program notes that I write, because I feel it's helpful to have some notion of what was in a composer's mind when a work was conceived and written. But beyond that, I just hope that people will feel that it's a meaningful experience for them in some way, that they feel that I've said something that connects with them on some kind of spiritual level, by which I don't mean just necessarily religious, but that there's been some communication about what life is like that they'll find consoling or maybe even amusing sometimes, or infuriating, or depressing, or whatnot.
Thank you. Thank you.